Have you ever stayed quiet in a room where everyone seemed to agree? Not because you agreed, but because you knew what would happen if you didn't. The conversation would shift, eyes would move, and suddenly, you'd be on the other side of something, labeled, sorted, placed. When the truth was, you didn't belong on either side. You were somewhere in the middle, holding something more complicated than the conversation had room for. So you said nothing. Most of us have been in that room, more often than we'd like to admit. And that silence, that small, careful act of self-editing, is one of the quietest costs of the world we're living in right now. A world that has become increasingly organized around opposites. Around the assumption that every question has two sides, that every person belongs to one of them, and that the space between is either weakness or confusion. This episode is about that space. And to understand it, we have to look at what created it. Episode 3, Polarity. Look at how the conversation is organized right now. Alpha male, beta male, MAGA Republican, woke idealist, the white lab coat, the woo-woo believer, trad wife, feminist, zealot, atheist. Those aren't fringe positions. They're the main characters of our current conversation. In politics, in health, in how we talk about relationships, identity, the body, the mind. And the way they're presented, they feel complete. Like each one contains a finished version of reality, and all you have to do is pick your side. What gets harder to see from there is everything in between. Part of why is simply this. Extremes travel fast. They're easy to communicate, easy to defend, easy to share. They compress something complicated into something you can fit on a bumper sticker or a 3-second clip. And that compression feels like clarity. It can even feel like identity. But clarity and truth aren't the same thing. What gets lost in compression is context. The part of the story that doesn't fit the frame. And the more we're exposed to those compressed versions of reality, the more we start to believe that's actually what reality looks like. That if something isn't clearly one thing, it must be the other. There's a phrase, nullius in verba. Take nobody's word for it. It's the motto of the Royal Society, and it was a radical idea at the time. That knowledge required direct inquiry, not received authority. Question what you're being handed. Look more closely. Follow the thread further than it's being handed to you. That's not cynicism. It's responsibility. Because when you actually look, when you resist the compressed version and move toward the thing itself, the edges start to soften. Something that seemed obviously right becomes more complicated. Something that seemed clearly wrong reveals layers you hadn't considered. Not because truth disappears, but because it turns out to be larger than the frame it was handed to you in. there's a pattern worth noticing in almost every domain where people are deeply divided. Politics, medicine, religion, media. The loudest voices tend to have something in common. They're not trying to complicate the picture. They're trying to simplify it, to make one frame feel like the only frame, to keep the question feeling settled. That's not unique to any one side. It shows up everywhere power concentrates. But the moment you recognize the frame as a frame, constructed, not discovered, something shifts. You're no longer inside it without knowing it. You stop being moved quite so automatically. And from there, a different kind of seeing becomes possible. Consider a star. At its birth, an explosion. Dramatic, violent, singular. And at the end of its life, something equally intense. But the form that intensity takes is not one thing. Even the ending contains multitudes. A nebula, a neutron star, a black hole. Each a different form that intensity can take. But between the birth and whatever ending arrives, there is a long, slow burn. Quiet, consistent, sustaining everything around it for billions of years. That middle period is what nobody talks about because it doesn't make for a dramatic story. We tend to associate extremes with power. Certainty feels strong. A firm position, a clear line. There's something satisfying about it. It feels like force. But the star's real work isn't at the edges. It's in the middle. And maybe something similar is true for us. The goal isn't to live at the poles. It's to learn how to hold a center within the space between them. Jung had a name for what we're looking at. He called them archetypes, the recurring patterns that structure human experience. And he named polarity as one of the most fundamental. Light and dark, expansion and contraction, creation and entropy. Not opposites that cancel each other out, but forces in a relationship, each one requiring the other to exist. Each one defining the other. The problem isn't polarity. The problem is when we collapse that relationship into opposition. When we stop seeing two forces in conversation and start seeing enemies. Because when identity becomes fixed to one pole, anything outside it begins to feel like a threat. And that's when polarity stops being a useful way to understand contrast and becomes something that just divides. What Jung was pointing toward is something more like a mandala, not a line with two opposing points, but a circle, balanced, integrated, whole. A structure that doesn't require you to choose a side because it's already holding all of it. That's not a passive image. It takes more to hold the center than it does to plant a flag at one edge. But it's also where the real understanding lives. And yet, even the language we use to describe polarity carries a judgment that nature itself never made. Negative, positive. We import moral weight into those words without thinking about it. Negative mood, negative outcome, negative person. But in physics, negative charge isn't bad. It's essential. Benjamin Franklin named the charges arbitrarily in the 1700s. It could just as easily have been reversed. Without the negative charge, there is no light, no life, no awareness. The electron isn't the dark force. It's the animating one. Nature doesn't assign meaning to its poles. It simply moves between them. And across traditions, separated by centuries and continents, something similar was understood long before the physics had language to describe it. In Taoism, yin and yang aren't opposing forces in a war. Yin is dark, receptive, inward. Yang is bright, active, outward. Neither is good, neither is bad. Each contains the seed of the other. Each requires the other to exist. Life happens between the poles, not at them. In Gnostic and mystical traditions, light and darkness weren't moral categories either. Light meant knowledge, consciousness, awareness. Darkness meant ignorance, not evil, just absence. The movement was always toward illumination, not toward the destruction of one side by the other. In many indigenous traditions, energy was understood as relational, not good or bad in itself, but healthy or disrupted depending on how freely it moved. Illness was blocked flow. Health was balanced flow. Harm was circulation interrupted. What's striking is how close that intuition maps onto what we now understand about the body. Bioelectric gradients, ion exchange. The nervous system firing across its vast network of pathways. Life at its most fundamental level is regulated movement between differences. Not the elimination of one pole, the conversation between them. Which means polarity isn't the problem. It never was. The problem is the meaning we've layered onto it. The judgment we've imported into a structure that was always, at its core, about relationship. And when flow is disrupted, when the conversation between opposites breaks down into opposition, something stops moving. Something that was meant to be dynamic becomes fixed. And what was a source of creative tension becomes instead a source of harm. Here's where it gets personal. Something shifts in the body, unexpectedly. And almost immediately, it gets defined. Bad. Wrong. Something to eliminate. And in the acute moment, that's often exactly what it feels like. Disruptive, frightening, unwanted. The first instinct is resistance. Why is this happening? What did I do? How do I make it stop? But there's another possibility. One that takes longer to arrive, that doesn't come easily, and shouldn't be rushed. It's not the opposite of grief or fear. It doesn't replace them. It sits alongside them. A quiet shift from, why is this happening to me, toward, what is this asking of me? That shift doesn't make the illness good. I'm not interested in that kind of reframing, but it changes the relationship to it. And that changing relationship begins to shape everything. What you notice, what you prioritize, how you care for yourself and for other people, and the way you move through the world as it continues to unfold. And sometimes learning to move within a world you didn't choose and wouldn't have chosen, with a kind of grace you didn't know you were capable of. The question illness eventually asks of everyone who sits with it long enough is a version of the same question polarity asks. Will you stay fixed at one edge? Victim or warrior? Broken or healed? Or will you allow the experience to be more complex than that? And then there's the landscape of treatment itself, which turns out to be its own form of polarization. Western medicine on one end, holistic practice on the other. The white lab coat versus acupuncture, herbal medicine, Reiki, entire lineages of healing dismissed with a word, each with its true believers, its dismissals of the other, its certainty that it holds the correct map. What gets lost in between them is the person who is actually sick. I've sat in an emergency room, watched the hours pass under fluorescent lights, in a waiting area full of people in various states of fear and pain. Nothing about that experience felt like care. It felt like a system protecting itself. And yet, there are brilliant doctors and researchers within that system. People who know how to step in when something has gone seriously wrong, when intervention is necessary, when the body needs to be put back together. And on the other side of that divide, practitioners who have spent equally devoted lifetimes studying traditions of healing that predate modern medicine by centuries. Acupuncturists, herbalists, energy workers, people who see the body as a whole system rather than a collection of symptoms to be managed. The individuals on both sides can be extraordinary. It's the war between them that isn't. Because the reality for anyone who has moved through serious illness with open eyes is that neither side holds the complete answer. Chemotherapy has saved lives. So has the decision to change everything else around it. Diet, stress, relationships, the interior landscape that no scan can measure, but that the person living inside the body knows is real. We are not simple systems. We are not one treatment problems. The factors that shape an outcome, physical, psychological, relational, spiritual, are so interwoven that the idea of a single correct protocol begins to look less like medicine and more like its own kind of dogma. This isn't an argument against any particular treatment. It's an argument against the war between them. Because when the war is the loudest thing in the room, the person in the middle, frightened, trying to make impossible decisions with imperfect information, loses access to the full range of what might actually help them. What if the question wasn't which side is right, but what does this particular person in this particular body at this particular moment actually need? Maybe the deepest cost of polarity, of constantly sorting everything into opposing camps, is that we stop looking. We arrive at a conclusion and we stop. We define the thing and the definition becomes a wall. And behind the wall is all the depth we didn't see because we stopped moving toward it. Emerson wrote that the man who remains true to his better instincts, who refuses to be tyrannized by facts alone, that man finds that the facts fall aptly and supple into their places. They know their master. When we lead from something deeper than reaction, when we resist the pull toward the easy definition, the compressed version, the pole, reality begins to organize itself differently. Not because the world changes, but because we're finally seeing more of it. So polarity isn't something to resolve, not a problem to fix or a tension to eliminate. It's something to see more clearly, to hold with more awareness, to recognize as relationship rather than opposition. Because the person who isn't rigidly positioned, who can hold complexity without needing to collapse it, there's a different quality to how they move through a room. More space, more openness. Not because they have no perspective, but because they're not imprisoned by it. That might be the work. Not changing the world's relationship to its extremes, but noticing how quickly we simplify. How fast we decide what something is before we've really looked at it. Charles and Ray Eames made a short film in 1977 called Powers of Ten. It begins with a man lying in the park and pulls back every 10 seconds, expanding the view by a power of 10 until we're looking at the known universe. Then it reverses, moving inward through the same man's hand, down through cells, through atoms, into the structure of matter itself. Two directions, infinite depth in both. Everything contains more than it appears to, at every scale, in every direction. The hand, the atom, the argument you had this morning, the diagnosis, the person you've already decided you understand. Nothing is simple if you're willing to look closely enough. And if we don't have the time or the willingness to really look, then perhaps we shouldn't be deciding, shouldn't be reacting, shouldn't be labeling. The world doesn't need more certainty. It needs more people willing to look past the edges of what they've already decided is there. I'm Lindsay. Thanks for spending some time in the space between. I'll see you in the next one. If this series has opened something for you, please consider sharing it. Independent work like this relies on listeners to sustain it. And if you'd like to support it directly, you can find a link in the show notes. Additional information about this series can be found at spacebetween.fm.